Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, a podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm his half-vampiric friend, cursed for all eternity. To be stupidly horny, what is with these characters, Jordy?
Very appropriately, we have made this quite a difficult no-nut November for both of us, Duncan, in our last two choices of books, because we've read Falling Up from Fourth Wing, somehow beating it out, an emphasis on the word beating. We did Empire of the Dawn by J. Christoph, the culmination, the climax to Empire the Vampire by J. Christoph, the same guy. He wrote all the books.
You're right, this is the final book in the Empire the Vampire trilogy. This is a big thing, this is a phenomenon. I think plenty of people have heard about it. And I'm sure if you're someone who've already read the previous two books, you know what your mind's going to be if you're picking up the third. So if that's you, let's share our opinions on it. And you've not experienced the trilogy yet, you're on the edges. Well, sometimes it's good to know if it's worth it. There's a lot of book here. So does it stick the landing? And that's one of the questions we're going to be trying to tackle. We've only finished, I think, like five trilogies ever on this podcast, so this is pretty prestigious for us to even get to the end. I think that says something on its own.
No, I mean, absolutely. I'm a big fan of this series. I really like them. I'll step up for them when people talk about the cringy, edgelordy prose. I've gone on a real journey with it, but this is a book series that it just keeps capturing me. Christoph obviously just has a way of hoodwinking me, because he can pretty much always trick me. He can always make me go, huh, I didn't see that coming, or, oh man, I'm really buying into this. I want to know what happens next.
I certainly had a very similar experience to you. It's kind of weird coming off of a Fourth Wing. And I had sort of a very similar vibe, which I wasn't expecting, which is, gosh, this can be so stupid in places and cringy in places, yet I am emotionally here. I'm invested. And even when things get really cringe at some points, it just manages, sometimes by the skin of its teeth, to pull back cringe and edge and on the few occasions flash into cool. And you're like, damn it, Christoph, you did it.
Yes.
I really didn't think
Absolutely.
You would.
There are a lot of moments in this where you just sort of go, oh, damn, that's pretty cool. Now, here's the trick, right? I have felt for a long time, since book one, a lot of this hinges on, so how is this going to end? The framing device of the story says, you know, the world is in plunge into eternal night, more or less. Vampires rule the world. Everything which our hero, Gabriel de Lyon, has accomplished has come undone. He's trapped by vampires. He's imprisoned. He's going to die. He's waiting to die. But he gets to tell his life story. And as it goes through, you as a reader keep being tempted by the author into believing that no, there has to be a way through. He keeps telling us that we've already lost, the grail is shattered, but surely there must be more to it. And I've always felt that this particular series is going to hinge on, does it end well? You might think that that every single story hinges on if it ends well, but I disagree. I don't think the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series ends well. I think it has a pretty bad ending. Still a great series, and I love it.
I feel nervous. You're going to ask me what I thought about the ending first. Are we going to go straight for that? Straight for the jugulum? Pun intended.
I certainly was going to ask that, Duncan. Are you going to force the issue? Are you going to make me pull my guns first and say how I felt?
No, I'm not. I'll go first. So, people, we've obviously spoken about this series. I cannot emphasise enough that, and I'll expand on this further, do go back, hear our previous opinions, and give the first book a go to see where your own tastes are. This is spoiler territory. Mm-hmm. We're going to unpick the final of the trilogy.
Genuinely.
But I'm still making a recommendation to try that first book and see if it's to your taste.
I agree. I think a really smart move would be to just try it on, say, Spotify. because it's way too long a book to listen to the whole thing on Spotify if you have an account. But if you start listening to it and you experience the first two chapters, then you can definitely get a sense for, oh, is this too edgy for me? Is this a little too cringe for me? Because if you're having a good time, and bear in mind that it gets a lot better than the first opening chapters, then you should give it a go, because it is a lot of fun.
Right, here we go. I thought the ending of this book was not as clever as it wanted to be, but having spent some time, I was still satisfied, even if I'm annoyed with the author.
I think that this ending is going to be divisive for a long time, and it's going to affect the ways in which, even though we've already made a decision about this, obviously, we recommend the series to people. Like, if this ending had been really bad, and personally, I'm not entirely happy with it, but overall, I think it is good. If it had been entirely bad, there's a good chance I'd be like, don't waste your time. Just move on. I'm someone who's quite happy to throw the baby out with the bathwater. If I think that something is wasting my time or is going to waste someone else's time, I won't recommend they experience it because there's so much stuff out there to enjoy. I still think this is worth the investment. And I think we can go a little further, Duncan, without getting into major spoiler territories, but not very far. So I'm going to talk about the one topic which I think is important in talking about this book, which is not spoilery. And in fact, it's something that I think everybody who wants to read the series should be spoiled on. And that is the art.
Oh, I'm glad you brought this up. This feels really relevant and something that I really want to talk about more now than I have in any of the previous episodes. Okay. Oh, right. Well, I'm just going to go for it then, Geordie. The artwork in this book made me really realise how the AI controversy on Feast of Crows has been going down. Because I'm not going to stand here and say that I love this art, or that the way I imagine the characters fully matches what the artist is putting down. But I have to say, it's always full of detail. Characters are clearly exactly as described, and it's always super relevant to the scene in the book.
I mostly agree. I mostly agree with that, sure. For those who have not experienced the other books or our discussions of the other book, right from the start, Empire of the Vampire, one of its selling points and why you should read, if you enjoy the audiobook, you should probably still get the physical book, is that it has pretty good art all the way through. I'd say pretty good in Empire of the Vampire. In Empire of the Damned, I'd say very good art. The artist for the first two books was Bon Otherwick, but she is not the artist for the third book.
Is she not? I am so sorry. I didn't even really notice that. I thought it was just an involving style.
No, the art is radically different. So I've been thinking a lot about how to talk about the change in styles, because we've spent the last 3 years, Duncan, describing the differences in writing as an art, not illustrations. That's not our wheelhouse, that's not our area of expertise, but Bon Otherwick's style feels very hand-drawn. It has a great emphasis on shades of black and white. It's sharp, it's stylistic, it's non-representational, it's not photorealistic. It's very evocative for the setting. And noteworthily, I think this is extremely significant, it really matches the vibe of everything in the book. It feels right, it feels the same, it feels appropriate for the cohesiveness of the book. And bearing in mind, the art inside is canon. Jean-François, the vampire historian, is making sketches in his book as Gabriel is telling his story. These are supposed to be canon. So it's weird that Jean-Francois, in the third book, like, I don't know, swapped to his other hand or was experimenting with a art style, which is not just very different from previous books, but is impossible to do with a pen because it's very clearly, like, done from an art pad.
Okay, well, I think, how do I put this? I do see your differences. As you've brought this up, I've now gone back and flicked between Dawn and the original Empire of the Vampire. And actually, as you say this, I can clearly see this. Particularly, you can see in the Empire of the Vampire, they're not as concerned with making them look like real humans. The proportions are completely off. Particularly, a very early one of Gabriel, you know, he almost looks like it's slightly 2D. His head is at a very sharp angle. You know, his jaw is exaggerated. It looks like something that's going to burst into animation rather than something that's going to be rendered out or be cast as live action.
Oh, wow. Oh, God. I just turned to a page. Okay. Well, I have something else to say about this now. Now, the change in artists has actually been a little bit controversial. I was not aware of this. I had no idea that the art was changed. In fact, I probably wouldn't have bothered to buy a physical copy of this book for my girlfriend's birthday if I had known that the artist was, one, different, and two, in my personal opinion, a lot worse. I'm not even going to say that it's, like, very bad. I do think it's it's uninspired, and it's much less interesting, and it just leaves a bad taste in my mouth, to be honest. The situation is that behind the scenes, the original artist, Bon, had created a lot of the pieces of art for this book. You can see it on her Instagram, which is this.
Monolimi Art. Also, it's Bon Orthwick. Sorry, that was just my mistake. I don't know why I pronounced it so badly. I will make Duncan repost some of her stuff, so you can find her art on our Instagram, is Visage Fantasy Podcast.
And not only can you recognize, oh yeah, I know these scenes from the book, you can actually say, oh, I've seen this art before. Because the second artist, Gonzalez Mendeveri, was provided with her art and then copied it.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's the noise.
That sounds a bit
low. That's the noise I made too. Now, I don't doubt that the publishers of Empire of the Dawn probably have the rights to do this. I doubt Orthwick is likely to, say, sue the company. And from what I've heard from fans of the series, she and Christoph remain on good terms. He was very polite about her and her work at a recent book signing event. However, she has been deeply upset by the use of her art, which is then used for inspiration by someone else. And the reason why she was removed from the book is that she was, apparently, behind on schedule. She had too much work on at the time. And as a result, she was not able to provide all the art required before the planned release date of the book. Which is unfortunate, but isn't necessarily anyone's fault. There's a lot of things that might contribute to that, and that's not really our place to dictate. What I can say is that it seems really shady to me to copy another artist's work. And I just checked. I went to a random page in the first book. It's not even her work on the third book that's been copied. I mean, obviously her designs have been copied because she decided what Gabriel looks like in print. And now a new artist has drawn Gabriel, essentially doing fan art of her work. But also, I just turned to a page in the third book, and there's a page from the first book that's in the third book, like at the very end, and that feels especially shady. You didn't even have to do that one.
Wow, this is quite a dampener on this book before we even get into the actual written story. I'm glad you kind of brought this all up. I have to emphasise that I thought the art in the third book was not terrible in and of itself, but, and I, to be fair, I felt this throughout a lot of it, it wasn't driving me deeper into the narrative. It's not something that I personally was like, okay, cool, there or not there. Not to undermine, obviously, the quality or the hard work that went into creating it, but it didn't add much for me.
Yeah, I had issues with it about, like, I feel like the composition of the pieces within are boring. Literally just boring. It's people standing there staring at the reader or looking at each other. It feels uninspired. It's noteworthy to me that the original artist had a lot on and was unable to meet the deadline to finish it before the end of the book. She only had about half of them done. And guess what? The new artist could do 100% of all of the stuff that had to be done in half the time. And I don't think it's that surprising. It's not as good. Now, I will also say this in Gonzalo's defense. His stuff does look better when you see it online and in color instead of in black and white. It is very muted and faded on the page, but actually it does pop a lot more when you look at it with color. That's exhausted everything I have to say about this art.
So let's get back into the prose of the book. Now, spoilers from here on out. This is the final warning, people. Everything's going to be down on the table from this point onwards. So starting out, this book once again is split between the perspectives of Gabriel, our vampire hunter, and his sister Celine, our full vampire hunter, maybe, who knows, let's find out more later. And the first little bit of this book is actually a Gabriel section, where, I'll be honest, goes on a bit of a side quest. He's off to fix his magic sword.
I thought this was quite likely that you would have an issue with this, because in like 3 of the last 4 books we've done, you've used the term side boss in a very derogatory sense. You've not, mini boss even, you've not enjoyed like people having smaller things they have to overcome before they can actually face the big bad guy.
What can I say? I watched Bleach as a young man, and it completely burnt me out on this concept. Gabriel goes off to fix his magic sword. Once again, I love this sword. It speaks to Gabriel. My heart goes out to this blade, who does not get enough backstory, characterization. This book teases you with sort of the origins and like their first meeting, Gabriel and Astrinka, his magic sword. And then sort of just skirts around it a bit more, leaving it a little bit more in the mystique.
I think that's probably a fair critique. The drama of this first section is supposed to be about what Gabriel doesn't know. And what we know as readers, as the dramatic irony of the scene, is that at the very end of the previous book, Celine has revealed to us, the reader, and no one else. She hasn't told Jean-Francois. It's strongly implied that Gabriel doesn't know this, that Dior, who died at the end of a previous book, came back to life. And this was a very funny moment of our previous episode, because Duncan, you had not realized this had happened, period. You had, understandably, confused Dior's reawakening with Marin's reawakening, which happened in the same chapter. And I was really focused on my conclusion, which is that, oh my god, Dior is a vampire now. Like, all of her powers have stemmed from some sort of pseudo-vampirism, and this is it. Jesus, the Redeemer, was actually a vampire, and that vampiricness has been passed down through Dior's line for generations, and now that she's died, it's finally awakened. And Gabriel doesn't know about this, so maybe he's never known about this, and he's going to spend the rest of his journey not knowing that Dior is still alive and kicking, and only Celine knows that. And then, right as we start the story, Jean-Francois knows this.
Yep. It's just kind of kicked out there.
And I don't know how. Actually, no, I do know how. But I don't know why it's supposed to make sense.
Part of this book, I think this opening really does kind of make light of this, and it comes back near the very end, is that the historian who's writing this down, Jean-Francois, he knows none of this tale. He is surprised by every twist and turn that Celine and Gabriel put out there, and you're just sat there like, when you get to the end, you go, hang on a minute, that shouldn't have been a twist to you. you should have known that in the world, because like you shouldn't have been surprised that that character died there, because you know that their body was found over here months later.
Exactly. We're introduced in this book to a sort of load-bearing character, that being Nicolette, one of Margot Chastain's grandsires, another vampire who was previously the ambassador to Blood Voss. She's around in a bunch of this story to justify how did Blood Chastain actually get Celine and Gabriel. And this is the parts where you're like, alright, this is like J. Christoph has to now like tie stuff together, and it's kind of obvious for stuff he did not think through. Like, he sort of was like, at some point it will make sense that Blood Chastain has Gabriel in captivity. And there is an explanation, and you might even buy into this explanation, but it does consequently make a lot of stuff not make sense. Even going back to the first book, why did Jean-Francois not know that Dieu la Chance was the Holy Grail? That was common knowledge amongst human beings, amongst Blood Voss. He knows someone who is in the ranks of Blood Voss. Why wouldn't she tell people? And maybe she did know, she did tell Margot Chastain, and maybe even Margot already knew that and just didn't tell Jean-Francois. But it does raise a lot of kind of strange questions about why is some of this stuff supposed to be a surprise? Why were we as readers led to believe that Celine had successfully hidden the resurgence of Dior? And then that's immediately undermined in the next book.
Again, we'll come back to it at the very end, but this book does quite the twist that at first you're like...
The twist does not satisfy the thing I just asked. It satisfies a lot of things, but not the thing I just
asked. No, but it's the fact that they built in a reveal. Oh, you're right. You know what? It doesn't even answer that. You're right. These characters have a certain lack of knowledge, given where we are. In fact, one of the main things I had in this book is realizing how close chronologically the framing narrative is to the core events of the story. Whereas in the first book, I assumed we were years out. And then this one, it's sort
of... It is. It's 3 years out when Gabe starts telling the present day part of the story.
I guess so. I guess a lot does happen in the interim. Right. Back to where I was saying, though. Before we get into all of that, even more plot holy stuff. Opening, we have a side quest to wrap up Gabriel's human parentage, and there's some stuff with his vampire friends, and they're all going to form a gang. And I enjoyed this bit, Geordie. I genuinely did enjoy this side quest.
Me too.
But I couldn't help thinking to myself, wow, the wheels are spinning a bit here. I was ready to crack on, and despite enjoying the character interactions, and to be honest, I've said this probably in quite a few stories, gosh, if this was just like a little short story, if you cut this out, I would have loved it. My only issue was that kind of wheel-spinning sensation, but I guess it was building the characters. We basically have Gabriel going back to his human mother's home city.
Where his ancestral home.
His ancestral home with his protege, his vampire friend, his vampire friend's non-vampiric lover, all from their school days.
You can
days.
Say their names. Actually, that's a question. Do you know their names?
There are so many names in this book that I was tumbling, particularly when we got into like the ranks of like the vampire court. I was like, nope, committing that to memory. You're getting one letter. But yes, we have... Gabriel has Aaron,
yes,
and Baptiste.
Yes.
Who are the two lovers. One is a vampire now. And he has his protege, mm-hmm, apprentice, Lachan.
Lachlan. Remember, he's not French, he's Scottish.
Lachlan. Excellent.
And also... his nickname is Lockie, is, you know, Lockie, like Lucky, so it's kind of cute. But if you didn't realise that it's Lock, like in a Scottish pronunciation, then you just think his name would be Latchy or something.
Lucky.
Oh, that's a horrible thing to call him, Lucky.
Yeah, I thought that was the joke. I thought the joke was he was Gabriel's Lucky.
No, he's not. What a horrible thing to say. Lachlan really is the Ahsoka Tano of this book in many ways, of the series even.
What, to Gabriel is Anakin?
Yes, because
yeah,
Gabriel is like the exemplar of an order of special knights. He falls from grace and leaves the order. And Lachlan, when he shows up in the second book, is just like, oh yeah, this dude was totally here the whole time. Just like, you're supposed to accept, like, oh yeah, Anakin totally always had a Padawan. Definitely, yeah. But the point is that she stays true to, like, the light, if not the Jedi Order. And whilst he falls from grace, he is kicked out of the Order and loses his faith. Hers is maintained, as is the case with Lachlan.
No, fair point. I thought he was a really fun character. I liked him as a side character. He first introduced as a bit of a stick in the mud in the second book particularly. But I like him kind of loosening it up and sort of coming to terms with the fact that his order is dead, thanks to Gabriel. So he's got to kind of like start thinking about what now? What do I want as a person? And that's a really cool kind of story beat to kind of follow out. What do you do when your quest is over? Most of our characters are not thinking that far ahead, but Lachlan, you know, his brain's starting to turn. He's starting to have to look forward mm-hmm. to things.
And the thing that really works about this first section, and what makes it kind of work as a isolated story, is that we have a bad guy who's never appeared in the rest of the story, has always certainly been there, quite appropriately in the background, because it's Blood Elon. All the other Bloods have been confronted in some way. They were fighting Voss exclusively in the first book. The second book, it was all Blood Divok. Elon shows up in this book for the first time, and they take out its like original vampire in a one really great inversion, where you as a reader start to realize something is very wrong. You can even start to guess, I think there are vampires behind the scene. But you don't realize that Gabriel has figured that out too, and he is acting like he's being led into a trap when actually he's springing his own. And there's this exciting moment where the situation is so much worse than you ever realized. Not only is it actually like, yes, vampires are controlling things from behind the scenes, but it's the first Elon, the father of whispers, who's never given a name. That's how mysterious and strange he is. And he's like a peerless beauty. He appears literally like an angel. And he's so powerful he can like control people's minds and like make them speak for him in a creepy chorus of thousands. And just when you think, oh my god, how is Gabriel going to get out of this one? Which is the classic question you should be asking of your fantasy hero. You have a badass entrance where Aaron, you think has lost his mind, bursts in with like a giant sword to fight his like ancestral vampiric forebear to save the day. And it's cool as hell.
This is a perfect example of what we mean. This book could be so cringe sometimes. You're just so worried about this. Now the master of whispers, yes, and he sits on high, and then but one of the vampires, one of the good vampires, he's going to come in with a really big sword and smack him about. And it could not work, but it does. It does so reliably. And I think it works so much of the time, because even when the characters kind of break in with their big, you know, broadswords to have that kind of like anime moment, they do get smacked about, and you feel the fact that these characters aren't immortal. Oh, well, depending on how you look at it. And they are getting properly beaten down, and that they are still only winning by just, I was going to say the skin of their teeth again, but like just by the edge of their wits, you know? They are outmatched physically, and they just have to have these little moments of cleverness and brilliance in the fights just to pull it off in the end. And that's what sells it for me.
Right, exactly. Like, they win this not because Gabriel is, like, an amazing swordsman. They don't win it just because Aaron, like, snuck up on a guy. They win it because by standing up and fighting, they give, like, one or two normal people in the scene the chance for their personal courage and ingenuity to win. Like, Gabriel's whole family, most of whom are not super vampire slayers, have to win this fight to save their, like, family legacy. So it's very cool. But the really important thing as you're reading this book is that Gabriel and Aaron are slipping into bloodlust. Aaron rips a guy's throat out and drinks his blood because he loses control. And Gabriel is fighting against this hunger in him, and it's overtaking him. He keeps resisting and resisting, but he's an addict. And he eventually, right as this section ends, he succumbs to it and drinks a woman's blood.
It was a dark ending to lead out on. It really did make me think, oh, is that the direction we're taking Gabriel? Is he going to be this horrific anti-hero?
And, well, I mean, that's what the book's been telling us since page one. One of the most iconic lines of the first book is he tells Jean-Francois, who the fuck told you that I'm a hero?
I know, but when you first read that, you get the impression, oh, it's just because he didn't, like, follow the rules of the order, but he's still, like, a good person at heart. And then this is the first scene when you go...
Well, Duncan, the context of that scene is that he shot an innocent woman to steal her horse.
No, fair enough, I'll take that back. Right, he's an arsehole, but we love him. This is the moment where I thought, maybe I won't be loving him by the end, and it plants that seed beautifully. And then this section ends.
Yes, part two.
And they're like, right, guys, what are we going to do? We're going to kill the Forever
Hell
King.
Hell yeah.
We're going to take on the big boss. And then we cut away to Celine.
And this bit is not as good.
It's really dull.
It's so slow. You know how we keep joking about Berserk really slowing down when they get on the boat? Guess what happens in this section? They get on the boat.
So... in this section, in Celine's narrative, and her main thrust for most of the novel, is the fact that she's part of this inner vampire cult that have this prophecy that they're going to bring about the parting of the Dark Veil, that they're going to protect the Chosen One, who is Dior, the Grail, and if they get her on the throne of the Empire, holding the Vampire Slayer sword... On the special day, then everything's going to be okay. And that's what Celine's trying to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And what we get at the end of the last book is that the head of Celine's kind of vampiric lineage has finally reawoken and is joining in on this. So that's really cool.
Yes, it is very cool, because the great thing about it is that Dior is back from the dead. We don't know how. Crucially... I was wrong. She's not a vampire. And this genuinely put me out for a long time. Not because it's necessarily bad storytelling. Just because I was, like, personally annoyed that I was wrong. So, that's on me. And I eventually came to terms with it. But for a long time I was like, I'm just stupid. My idea was better. However, Dior comes back to life. This is proclaimed as a divine miracle. People's adoration of her is higher than ever. I noticed something kind of funny, which I hadn't realized before. Dior is given a number of different titles in this book. She is called the Red Hand of God. She's called the Holy Grail. She's called Demoiselle Le Graal. And specifically, Saint Dior. Saint Dior. But here's a funny thing I noticed upon the third book. Saint Dior means Saint Dior, but it could be translated, Duncan, as Holy Treasure. Like the Holy Grail.
Oh. Oh, well done.
That's really cute.
You can tell he set that one up. He was so happy when he wrote that. He thought, no one's going to notice what I'm going to do.
Because she doesn't get called Saint Dior until, like, the second book. So, yeah, you wouldn't realize it at first. So it is well set up. Now, as you say, Marin awakens and she tells the rest of the followers of the Grail, this is the prophecy. She reveals the full extent of the prophecy, which was previously unknown until the end of the second book. And Dior's job is she has to sit on the throne of the Empire. Which is a big ask. And I was like, Jesus, is this book going to be about Dior, like, conquering all the kingdoms in a tide of violence? Fortunately, that is not what happens. She just spends a long time on the boat until she gets to the capital city.
So where does this bit kind of fall over? And I don't want to spend too much time because it is a dull section. I think where it falls down to the fact that, you're right, they're just on a boat. There's no real action scenes to break it up. It's a lot of talking. And we basically get a sort of slow progression of Dior's relationships with her followers, namely her romantic interest, Rain.
Rain.
Excellent. And we also get her gain this kind of building her relationship with Celine in this kind of mentor student, where Celine is teaching Dior some of her, I'm going to call it blood magic, blood bending.
Yeah, fair enough.
What's going down?
Sanguomancy, but yes, it's blood magic.
We also get a bit more Celine's backstory.
I'm going to contradict you there, Duncan. I'm going to say we get a lot of Celine's backstory. Dare I say, too much of Celine's backstory.
I didn't need any of this, all right? I was really trying hard not to skip through.
Yep.
But we talk about Christoph, and we talk about him doing twists, and you're not always seeing it. From the moment this started, Geordie, I saw her entire backstory. I was like, oh no, she's met these people who were originally, when she first met them, were going to kill someone, but, oh, maybe they're not that bad. What's that? There's this young lad, this human lad she's a bit sweet on. And we've drawn attention to the fact that her mouth is a hideous maw. Oh, what could possibly be happening here? And we know that everyone else is dead by the present.
Literally what the only thing, the only mystery that really extends is, how did Celine get so powerful so quickly? How did she kill Gabriel's father, Wolfric? And why did she kill Gabriel's father, Wolfric? And then the previously unasked question, what's really going on with the Asana? Because up till now, their goals were pretty, seemed almost obvious, right? They want to, they are good vampires. They're vampires that kill vampires. And they want to help Dior save the world because that's good. And then that is complicated by this section. That is not to say that there is nothing good here, but it's way, way too long. This could probably be like 3 chapters at the most, and instead it's coming onto a quarter of the whole book.
I personally found the only bit of this that I really enjoyed was the very first section where Celine's telling the story of how she first came to as a vampire. And her early moments of wandering around her, like, slaughtered village and not realising she's a vampire yet and not realising she looks like a walking corpse. And I thought it was this really nice small moment where, like, first humans are coming on the village and she thinks she can run to them and be like, help me, help me. And they're like, oh my God, it's a vampire. And, like, that little moment, a little bit of heartache, a little bit of the crushing realisation, a bit of that humanisation of Celine, and the fact that, you know, she has gone through a real rough time. You know, becoming a vampire is not a pleasant experience. So, that was good. The rest, I genuinely, it didn't advance the plot.
It did make the plot go, because, you know, we learn important stuff in it, but, as you said before, it could be much briefer. I mean, actually, once again, there is a canon reason why it's written like this, but the canon reason does not make it a better book to read. So this was a bit of a chore, and I was glad when it was finished. And hell, we don't even get the conclusion of Celine's backstory in this part of the book. You have to wait till part 5 for that to happen. The other thing that's really noteworthy about this section of the book is, quite possibly, the most unforced error in the entire series. We're seeing a lot of negative stuff. We already said some good stuff about Gabriel. And let me be clear, the action scene at the end of this section is really badass. And I liked it a lot. This right here was so unnecessarily complicating that I was like, this might ruin the book for me, and I am a third of the way in. So Phoebe, she comes up to Dior's girlfriend, Rain, and says, so Rain, I've been thinking, and you know how we know who your mother is? She was the Queen of Oswey. She's dead now. And you know how we don't know who your father is? I've just been thinking that maybe your dad is my now dead, the wolf shapeshifter Connor, who appeared at the end of the second book in a really great twist, and then immediately died, he might be your dad. You might be my kinda sorta stepdaughter. And Rain's like, wow, that's a big revelation. The evidence you've suggested is actually kind of compelling, so yeah, that does make some sense. Okay, cool. I'm probably the Connor, the daughter of Connor, the White Wolf, who is one Elric reference after another. A genuinely astonishing number of Elric references one after another. Duncan, did you catch them all?
When you say them all, besides the general motifs, besides all of the white-haired, big black sword-wielding chaps walking about, nah, didn't see any.
On top of the fact he's called the White Wolf, that's kind of a big one, he is the descendant of a woman called Stormbringer, and he's described in this book as a, like, vagabond prince exploring the world he is destined to rule in order to understand it better.
I mean, I like a reference. I like Elric. I don't know what this necessarily added, other than...
I'm not criticising it, I just find it amusing.
I'm glad.
What I am criticising...
Yes.
What I am criticising quite extremely is right at the end of part two, they're in a massive battle against the forces of Voss. They arrive at the capital city, Alexandra. Alexandra? Yes?
Augustine?
Augustin, thank you. They arrive at the gates of Augusta. They're fighting against the Undying Legion. They're losing. One of the Forever King's kids rocks up. She looks badass as hell in like a suit of armor, carrying a scythe, riding a white horse. And they're losing bad, despite everyone pulling out all the stops to fight her. Rain gets sliced in two. It's been revealed that as the daughter of Connor, it's possible she will start to manifest Dusk Dancer abilities and could turn into a wolf. As Dior lies beside her and is like weeping because her girlfriend is dying, she suddenly begins to transform. And you're like, ah, Rain's powers are manifesting. Because of the use of pronouns, this is confusing. Because it's not her. Dior is the one transforming into a wolf. Dior is the Dusk Dancer. Wait, what the fuck is going on?
Right, Geordie. I'm glad we're on the same page with this, because I was so confused. I actually was like, wait, who were we told was the parent of the child of Connor? Was it Dior? Let me check that section. No, that wasn't it. Let's roll back. Okay, Dior. Was so lost. I was like, it's one of those things where it's like, what a twist. Was it set up? I'm not sure this time.
Well, that's the thing. Duncan, how did you feel overall about the twist that Dior is at least part Dusk Dancer? Not vampire, Dusk Dancer.
In this particular case, I was like, okay, is this meant to explain away some of her magic powers? I'm sort of cool with that. But my biggest problem is, we spend a lot of time with the Dusk Dancers, these being the, I don't know, I'm not going to call them werewolves, that's not quite right.
They are.
Well, yeah, but they can transform into other things.
Lycanthropes, then.
We spent a lot of time with them in the last book, and I was just like, I feel like I wanted a few more breadcrumbs to be left for me leading into this moment, but I wasn't anti this moment, you know, on principle.
The only hint in the second book that this could happen is that the Moon Maidens are like, well, Deal or Chance can't be the Grail because our prophecy says that the Grail is going to be a Dusk Dancer. And so you go, all right, so it sounds, which is, now to say that out loud, that's actually a pretty good setup, because in that one I'm like, okay, well, that's just you writing prophecies about yourselves. And when it's revealed that Rain is potentially a Dusk Dancer, I'm like, okay, so that's why it makes sense. Like, the prophecy is going to be fulfilled in a roundabout way because these two will marry, and therefore, like, the queen is going to be, yes, the Grail, and also the queen, the other one, will be the, will be the Dusk Dancer, so it will be fulfilled in a roundabout way. Instead, this big twist is actually Dior is a Dusk Dancer. That's why she came back to life. It wasn't an act of God. Dusk Dancers always heal from their wounds if it isn't afflicted by silver. So, or if it's like too extreme, like getting your head chopped off. So, Dior came back to life because of her healing powers, which only manifest after your Dusk Dancer parent has already been slain, and Connor had literally died like 10 seconds before Dior did. That's why the powers only manifested then. Okay. Now, here's the knock-on. That means that Dior and Rain, who are girlfriends, have the same dad. They're half-sisters. And thankfully, they have not had sex. Dior has been complaining all boat journey about the fact that Rain won't sleep with her. And on one hand, you're like, well, that's good that that didn't happen, Christoph. On the other hand, it feels super weird that Dior has spent a lot of his book griping in kind of a frat bro-y way about the fact that Rain won't sleep with her. And this feels so unnecessary and super gross. Why did you choose to write this book when it wasn't even really that? If it was not very well set up that Dior was a Dusk Dancer, it certainly was not set up that Rain was the daughter of Connor in a previous book.
It wasn't touched on, I'm going to say, at all. And I'll be quite honest, I'd forgotten that Rain had this mystery father backstory. So it really felt like someone had just walked up to her and gone, you know that father, you don't know who they are, letting the audience know. Well, I think it's this person, letting the audience know. And then you're like, okay. And then we get to this point. And also at this point, we're like, wait, so we're confident that Connor is now Dior's dad. It can't be another Dusk Dancer. Definitely was him because of the timings. How did that happen? Like, we never really go into that story particularly.
I mean, but literally the story is that Connor slept with a prostitute because we know that Dior's mother was a prostitute.
Yeah, I suppose that is all you need. It's amazing how that is given such conciseness. Yet, Celine, we keep going and going. Anyway, enough of that moaning.
The point is that it's weird and gross and genuinely made me go, oh no, I think this book sucks, actually. And I spent a lot of this book going, I'm really struggling to get past the fact that this is like a plot point. It feels icky. Why did you choose to write this?
Oh, see, I didn't have that issue as much, and maybe that says more about my moral character, but I thought it was simply a way of like, how do I put this? Like, Christoph decided he didn't want to use Rain as like the primary love interest. I was like, oh, is this how you're gonna, like, are you gonna bring someone in?
Okay.
And genuinely,
that's weird.
I know, it was a weird way to do it. And then I actually went, it wasn't until a bit later when they introduced a character called Philip, who's a current prince of the Empire, who then Dior set up to marry. I'm like, wait, was this just your roundabout way of making Dior get with a straight love interest? Because it's only at that point that I went, really, Christoph? Really? You're doing that?
I never had that interpretation of it, but it sounds like we had equally icky in different ways interpretations of how this was being handled. Let's not delay on this any longer, because the important thing is that this revelation really affected my perception of the book, even though, and please bear in mind, we're now in the spoiler zone, it's not true. Rain is not Dior's sister. She figures it out later in what I think is actually a very well-written scene, because Rain gets explained to her by her older sister, who you have forgotten exists, but is you're told about in the previous book and in this one. And so when she shows up, you go, oh, right, yes, of course. And she says to her sister, oh, actually, your dad is not, whoever this Connor guy is not Connor. It's your father is like this guy who you've never heard of before. And there's a very good reason that you shouldn't have been told about it. And what's really great about this scene is that everyone is speaking of cross purposes, because Celine, who's watching in, doesn't say what she's figured out. Rain is like, oh my god, the important thing I've learned is that Dior is not my sister. We can have sex now. Hooray! And what her older sister is not telling her is, you're my daughter. That's the big secret. That's why this was hidden from you. We're not sisters. I'm your mum. And she never tells Rain this because you can feel the shame and anxiety in this scene. And everything makes a lot of sense about why her parentage was hidden. It doesn't justify the, like, ickiness and the inclusion of the stuff in the previous scene, but it creates this moment of catharsis where you're like, hooray, they can be together. And then, in the immediate subsequent chapter, where Rain's life is, like, extremely threatened, you go, oh no, everything was good and now everything's gonna be bad, stop!
All I can say about this whole section is, yes, it was a bit weird, it did feel a bit maybe unnecessary, although I really liked the swing background that, like, Georgie's just described. But I mostly spent most of the section thinking to myself, gosh, did I watch a Studio Ghibli movie that did the same plot? And I did. It's called Up on Poppy Hill. And it was weird there.
Interesting. This, we have a different take on this, because my thing about the, like, oh, maybe we're brother and sisters, actually, is, J. Christoph has always been, as we've spoken about with Elric, he's always been very naked about where he gets his inspiration from. The Last of Us, Darkest Dungeon, The Witcher, Interview with a Vampire, obviously. And now, apparently, I'm thinking, as we get this whole, maybe they were actually sisters all along, I'm like, oh man, I guess he really likes Shadowhunters, huh? Shadowhunters Duncan is a book series by Cassandra Clare. It's a very, very famous YA fantasy series, and it was coined from a Harry Potter fanfiction shipping Draco Malfoy and Ginny Weasley. The big twist is, at the end of the first book, if you were reading the fanfiction, and I'll translate it into fanfiction talk, is the big villain says, no, wait, you don't understand. Yes, you, Ginny, are my daughter, but that's not Draco Malfoy. That's Ron Weasley. You've been lusting after your brother this whole time. Bum, bum, bum.
Well, okay. I don't really know how to come back from this. Jordy, I'll leave it for you to make me read that on the podcast one day. I am
never,
not hunting
never,
for that myself.
Never, no, never. We're not doing that. We're not doing that. We have better things to do. Let's move back to Gabriel, all right? And briefly, because we need to crack on. Here's the next big twist.
Yes, Gabriel, he gets his lads, he gets some men together. There's a bit of fighting, but no need for the mucky details. There's a very graphic sex scene with him and Phoebe, but again, let's fly past that. I certainly did when I was reading.
That was the point where I was like, oh my god, how horny can this book be?
I want to kind of go back to the second book, because I don't remember it being this graphic. I remember when they have their, like, sex scene in the previous book, it's been a lot more intimate. It was a lot, I felt a lot more about, like, these wounded characters who'd lost loved ones slowly coming together. It felt nice to be invested in that scene, because it was about them healing and connecting. This scene in this book is just
broken parts fitting together.
Horniness. It is one character seducing the hell out of another and them getting at it.
The point is that Gabriel shows up to fight the Forever King. He's going to finally get his revenge. And the crucial thing here is that Phoebe shows up and says, hi, turns out to fulfill the prophecy, we need Ash Drinker. Can you please bring her to the capital and not try and get revenge now? And Gabriel says, no, I'm going to try and get revenge here. It feels a bit off for the character. And you go, oh man, would Gabriel really do that? That doesn't feel right. Phoebe steals Ash Drinker and he decides to go through with the plan anyway, even though it feels like they can't possibly win. And again, you're like, oh wow, that feels weird and wrong. Why would he do that? And then predictably, the fight goes terribly. And you go, what is going on, Christoph? Why are you writing the scene this way? It doesn't make any sense. And then they lose. They lose badly.
They do. And in the final moment, everyone's, like, getting overwhelmed. They've been ambushed by the undead. Gabriel's on the battlements. He's staring down the Forever King. And you're like, we're only at the halfway point. He ain't killing him now. And we get genuinely what I thought was a really powerful moment. Like, this took me back. Gable was facing down the Forever King, and the Forever King's like, to paraphrase, I think you would rather have a chat with me than duel me to the death. And Gable's like, I will never heed your tongue, foul, dead thing. And then the Forever King's like, really? What if I revealed your daughter?
It's patience! She's alive! Oh no, she's not alive. She's a vampire. What a twist!
What a twist! I like this twist. When this happened, I was like, oh. Did you not?
No!
Oh!
Because I was like, this is crazy. It's a bridge too far. Now, actually, I have to say this. My initial reaction to the twist was, this is ridiculous. There's no way this can be true, because Gabriel would know if he didn't bury his daughter, right? And I was like, this is a... Phoebe's retcon in the second book was a bit much, but I was willing to buy into it. But I can't buy into this retcon. And yet, it really did get to me eventually. Like, having patience back, having Gabriel, like, sing her a bedtime story and have her factor into a lot of his decisions going forward, and having her present at the climax and die in the climax again, that stuff was really impactful. So yes, I had a bad initial reaction, but I did buy in. And I was like, fucking hell, J. Christoph, you know how to push my buttons.
It's this really cool kind of sense of, you're right, you're like, oh, it's a bit of a retcon, but you know what? For what this adds, for the extra layer this adds, I'm totally worth it. Particularly, there's an element here which was sort of undermined by Gabriel being like, I'm going after the Forever King and not coming back and joining Dior earlier, which slightly dampened it. But ultimately, Gable's had this whole thing of like, I've lost one daughter, I see Dior as like my new surrogate daughter, and I will always put her first. So the fact that his old daughter gets resurrected, you're like, finally, like, this is the conflict that could tear Gabriel apart.
Exactly.
Trying to pick between his two daughters.
Exactly. And he has allegiance to both of them, because he wants to go to Dior. And if Fabian's like, I have your daughter as hostage, I could destroy her at any time. I don't want to, but I could. And that means you're mine. And then Fabian says, and you should help me, because the bad guys the whole time have been the Asana, not me.
What a twist.
And a good twist, actually. Yes. Because on one hand, yeah, I've always thought these guys were shady as hell, and I've never really trusted them. But I more was like, I think they're bad people. I don't think they have bad end goals. I think they have bad ways of doing the right thing. But through this book, Gabriel actually starts to question himself. Hey, it's kind of weird that they knew that the Blackened Veil was going to happen before Day's death. So is it really about the Blackened Veil? Like, is that really Day's death? And at first you go like, oh yeah, that kind of doesn't make sense, right? And then you go, well, it's a prophecy, so they could see the future. So, well, then yeah, they would. Of course they would know about Day's death, because it's a prophecy. And then you go, well, maybe it's not a prophecy. What if it's like instructions? And then Fabian Vos tells you off page, and then we get Celine to take over again, and things are starting to get interesting.
The Asani's plot is coming to fruition. We've had Rain is running to see Dior and tell her that they can actually have sex. Gable is on his way back to undo whatever the Asani are doing, and they all meet in the same room. What a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence. What are you talking about?
Sorry, was an excellently executed plan.
There's a big fight between Gabriel, Marin, and Celine, which is very well written. It's very badass. And just as everything is going to go, just as everything's about to turn on its head and Gabriel might be killed by Marin, Marin instead runs Rain through as she arrives with backup and then frames Gabriel for having killed Dior's love interest.
Gabriel is captured, he's put in the tower. Dior shows up, she's like, how could you? You traitor, you've joined the evil side. I know it, I won't listen to you.
Great drama. It's so agonizing, like, no, please stop, no!
And then we proceed to the final moment, the culmination of the prophecy. It is going to be Dior's wedding day. Long story, wedding the prince, prophecy be fulfilled, whatever.
Yeah.
And, oh, sorry, before we happen to this, she needs to get Astrinker. The sword needs to be in Dior's hand. But Geordi, Astrinker can speak when someone holds her. She speaks directly to their mind. And Astrinker knows what's going on.
So, Marin, to make Celine prove her loyalty, says, take Astrinker, this beloved character who we've been with for three books, and break her.
This is actually one of the more heart-wrenching moments in the book.
Heart-wrenching is the word. It was devastating. It was so sad.
It's the fact that Astrinker, we already know, has had a small wound before, and she's never quite spoken properly. You know, she's not 100% there as it is. So it gives her this kind of like gentle innocence in a lot of the scenes. So it's like, why are you going to do this? Are we going to shoot Lenny?
It's like, it's not even shooting Lenny. It's like violently lobotomizing Lenny and then dragging him around for the rest of the book because Astrinker is still there as this sorrowful, sad shadow of her former self. And you're like, fucking Celine, how could you do this? I want to see you get barbecued.
This is the moment where I really jumped on Gabriel's perspective of like hating Celine in the framing narrative. I was like, yes, I'm sure she does other stuff, but this is the unforgivable.
But everything is moving in Viasana's favour, but that's a bad thing because the true nature of a prophecy is revealed.
Oh, it is. The black veil shall be parted, and everyone assumes it is Day's death. The great clouds that block out the sun have allowed this vampire holocaust to take place. But it's not. The black veil is life itself. It is the world they live in. They intend to bring about, basically, Judgment Day, and end everything.
Because they believe that, like, if they die whilst they're on Earth, they'll go to hell because they're damned, they're vampires, they're monsters. But they say there's a loophole because Judgment Day says that everyone who's alive will be lifted up to heaven. So if they can artificially accelerate Judgment Day, which will come about when the like Scion of the Redeemer is placed on the throne and holds this angelic blade as was foretold, that will bring about the end of the world. And the great thing about this is like, that might be bullshit. There is no real reason to believe that that is true. Like, God probably does exist in this. There's some evidence for that. Dior is definitely really special. But would this actually work? Well, we sure can't risk it, so we gotta stop these guys.
And then we get this great moment where everyone's coming to, it's like the critical point. You're like, who's going to come in and save them? Someone has to. We get to the framing narrative. So we need to get out of this situation. But who's it going to be? Who's it going to be? And I'm sat there thinking, okay, you know, we have characters that we haven't really kept up with. There are other heroes that were with Gabriel. Maybe one of them. Maybe Baptiste or Aaron is somehow going to come in. Maybe Phoebe is going to break out from her kind of like thrallship.
Enthrallment.
Enthrallment. That's the right term. Thrallship. Can't believe I said that. Enthrallment at the last moment. That was genuinely my theory. Because we've seen people break out in like critical moments before. So I was like, come on, come on. Who's going to save them? Who's going to save them? Who saves them, Geordi?
What I really like about this is that my thinking is Celine knows the truth now and she's warring in her head. Should I tell Dior? And she decides at first not to. And then finally, she just can't bring herself to lie anymore. And so even though she knows it means making an enemy of Marin, and almost certainly means her death, she says, I have to tell you the truth. And she tells Dior, in the middle of like a dance hall, on her wedding day, this is what's really going on. And Marin is watching her the whole time and is like, okay, that's it, you're fucking dead. And Dior says, you just saved your life, Celine. And then a figure steps up behind Marin and slices her in two because Gabriel was not locked in the tower at all. He was already freed. And then as they start this fight, Marin starts to get away and you're like, oh God, what are they going to do? She's flying away as a cloud of moths. And then Dior turns out who was practicing her sangromancy before, but wasn't that good at it. She was a lot better at it than we were led to believe, and she destroys Marin, ostensibly the villain of the entire book, and we have like a quarter of the way to go, so what the hell is going on?
What's going on is that we learn some critical points. We learn that the fundamental trust between these two characters, Dior and Gabriel, is completely unbreakable. Dior sees in Gabriel her papa, and she will never think he would betray her.
So when Gabriel shows up, she doesn't just take everyone's reasoning for it, and the narrator points out a lot of ways in which they could get around Marin's detection about how this could be sorted out. How could Phoebe be set aside after being enthralled by Marin? And then it concocts pretty good reasons for why this is able to happen. And again, you start to think, well, hang on, how did some of this stuff happen? Like, can Gabriel really just sneak up behind Marin? She wouldn't detect that, but it's so compelling that you kind of just sort of brush it aside. And the really exciting thing is, like, the world has been saved, right? Judgment Day can't happen. But it also means that everything they've worked for up till now, it's all been for nothing. You know, Dior is still the Holy Grail, but she's no longer the way to save the world and end Day's death. So as Fabian Voss is marching towards them, they have nothing now. There's no ace in the hole. So what are they going to do?
I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to have some epic vampire battles. They're going to have multiple characters going up against multiple princes of forever. They're going to have clever moments, charges, key points where you think a character, they've got to die. And some characters are going to die in this battle. Over the next...
Oh yeah, a lot of important characters are wiped out.
Over the next 150 pages, we are going down the list of our side characters and taking them out one by one. Until really?
Lachlan, dead. Gabriel's new cousin from this book, dead. In the very climax, Aaron and Baptiste... Aaron, but Baptiste betrays the human race! What the hell? And Aaron and Baptiste die in the climax, and that's horrible.
It really makes you go, because we know this from the first book, Gabriel is the last of his order of the Silver Saints. So you get to this fight and you're like, oh shoot, they've all got to die now so we can have that statement.
And the thing about like Aaron and Baptiste is that like Baptiste was never a Silver Saint. Aaron was kicked out of the order. He's not a Silver Saint anymore. By the end of the second book, he's a vampire and doesn't even have magic tattoos anymore. He's not a Silver Saint, so he doesn't have to die for that to be true. So this whole time, I'm thinking, Aaron and Baptiste, despite being told they should be dead, they might get away with it. And then they die, and you go, oh my god, no, you can't even spare them?
And then we arrive at our final... Well, no, I was about to say final climax, that's not true. The climax of the narrative that Gabriel and Celine have been telling. The story of how the Forever King, who we knew from the first book, Gabriel does kill. And the story of Dior.
It's literally one of the first lines of the book.
We're going to find out, Dior, how Gabriel finally, truly this time, loses the Grail forever.
The climax is like, it's definitely suitably epic. It's like full on Mordor. They go to the one part of the country that the Empire they haven't been to before, to Talhost, which is like volcanic, cold Palestine, like Middle East land. Like this is where all the biblical stuff happened, but it's all made up of like black volcanoes, blighted wilderness, and it's freezing cold everywhere. We know very little about Talhost, really, compared to the other countries, but they go to, like, the site of where the Redeemer, where Jesus was, like, killed, to recreate, where Fabian Voss is recreating the death of the Redeemer, because it's finally been revealed. Why does he want Dior this whole time? Because he has been told, this is not a joke, by Satan himself, hey, if you get the Holy Grail, you will be able to control who comes back from the dead as a vampire. It won't be random anymore. You will have control over it.
This is incredible. I really like the characterization of Fabian at these kind of, as we go through this book, because he's been this distant, kind of stoic, evil figure. It's really nice to see, you know, what makes him tick. He's trying to recreate the creation of the first vampires. Mm-hmm. The original five were all there when the Jesus figure was executed, and vampirism was their like eternal curse. So Fabian's like, if I can recreate that moment and execute the Grail, I can start handing out the curse to others. Something that gets touched on multiple times in his interactions with Gabriel is that, in a way, despite Gabriel being like his biggest thorn in his side, his main nemesis, Fabian kind of loves the fact that he at least has a nemesis again. Like, this is a guy so old and so powerful. The fact that someone mm-hmm. is actually messing up his plans is kind of interesting for him.
Yeah, absolutely. What I really, one of my favourite lines in the first book is when Fabian, Fabian visits Gabriel in his like retirement house. That makes it sound like he's really old. He finds him in his house with his wife and says, do you know what your great sin was, Gabriel? And he forces Gabriel to go through the majority of the seven sins, being like wrath, pride, surely, God forgive me, lust. And he says, no, your sin was sloth, because you started something and you didn't finish it. And then he kills Gabriel's whole family. And that's so fucking chilling and badass. And you're waiting this whole time for Fabian to show back up and for there to be this great confrontation. And it's a pretty crazy fight. Everything is on the table. They are leaving.
It really is. It's this beautiful increasing spiral where Gabriel and Cidaline are getting knocked about. Characters are dying. This is when Baptiste and Aaron die. They're on the last day, so they're getting wounded, but they keep going at it. And each time they come so close to finishing it at last. And Fabian just turns them away or just holds them off. Until eventually Dior ultimately makes the final move that seals Fabian's fate.
That's right. All of them finally working together through Dior's sanguomancy, through Celine's vampiric powers, through Gabriel's skill and guts, and the death of Ashdrinker finally as he drives it through Fabian's heart. They finally slay the Forever King. They're all completely bested. Gabriel lies dying. Celine gets set on fire. But that's not all, because there's one more character who's in this final scene, Duncan.
Patience, Gabriel's vampire resurrected daughter, attacks Celine in this moment. She's furious, for Celine has just murdered Papa Fabian. How could she?
That's right.
And yeah. I love this cutback between Gabriel and Celine in the framing narratives. They're in the same room now telling this story. And Celine's going, it was an accident. I didn't mean to. I'm so sorry. And yeah. Gabriel's like, how could you? I don't care. It happened. Because in this scene, Celine throws Patience off to get her away from her. And Patience falls into a chalice of Dior's blood. And her blood will doom any vampire that touches it. And Patience mm-hmm. dies. And I love the detail on this. It's horrific. In flame, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. screaming. This, still a child, by the way, still maybe turned into a vampire, but they've only had like 3 years since they were actually That's killed. Right. So they are still like maximum, I reckon, 12 years of consciousness. And they die.
But she was 11 years old when she died, so she'd be 14 when she died.
And you're like, oh, I get now why these two want to murder... Well, I get why Gabriel wants to murder Celine.
And then we find out why Celine wants to murder Gabriel, because Dior, who's very fucking badass, crawls her way off the wheel where she's been flayed and crucified, crawls her way over to Gabriel and is like, drink my blood, be healed. And he's like, let me go, just let me die. And she says, like, don't, you said you'd never leave me, which is just a total knife twist in the heart, because that's her big damage, is it being afraid of people leaving her. So Gabriel starts to drink her blood so that he can be healed. But once he starts, he's an addict, so he can't stop. And here's why Gabriel's been racked with guilt all this time. It's because he kills Dior.
This moment, the punch of it, and the fact that I was like, I should have seen this coming. Obviously, this is what we're leading up to. Gabriel has been so many times in this book, it's been reinforced that he's losing control, that he's giving in to his bloodlust, that it's implied that he murders two innocent characters in this book. We don't see it happen on page. And we're like, oh my god, he's finally going to break. Obviously, this is what's going to happen. This is that moment. It's imagine if in the first Twilight book, Edward had actually just sucked all the blood out of Bella and we hadn't had sequels. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. Great world. So,
Duncan.
I've seen the movies. I'll read the books eventually.
Not on the pod, you won't. Here's my question for you, Duncan. As we finally come to the end, like, Jean-Francois closes his book. He finally has everything he's looking for. He has all of the answers. And he's going to go back down to the party where all of the vampires have been gathering in order to watch Gabe and Celine be ritualistically slaughtered. My question for you, Duncan, is, how much of this shit did you buy?
Here I've got to tell you, mate. Here you need to know. I bought this hook, line and sinker. I was completely down.
Amazing. Great.
There were a few questions and I still had thoughts in my head. I thought, well, we know something's up here. One couple of characters got sent away. Like, there may still be a sliver of hope. But I genuinely thought this might be a story.
We know Joachim is alive. Like, he shows up at the end of the second book.
So I was genuinely thinking, maybe this is the story about how, like, Gabriel gets away this time, makes a commitment to keep fighting forever in Dior's memory, and that's the note we're going to leave off on. Like, I'd take that. Wouldn't bit surprising, but, like, I could take that. That's just the tone of the series.
Now, there was a lot of stuff I did buy into. I was still surprised by the end in some parts of it, but overall, I really expected a lot of what happened at the end. Because when I'm reading Gabriel's section in the front, I'm like, I know you're lying to me. Like, I know you're bullshitting me. You've been telling me for, like, the entire second book, Celine and Gabriel are calling each other liars. We already know that they tried to hide Dior's resurrection. We know from the start of the first book that Gabriel did know that Dior got brought back. Like, that's not a surprise to him in the third book. I mean, a surprise to present-day Gabriel in the third book. And then at a certain point, I sat down, I said, I closed the book, and I said, what if Chloe's alive? Like, wouldn't that make sense? Dior can bring the dying back to life. So what if Gabriel stabbed Chloe, and then Dior, because she's so nice, brought her back? And maybe she's been out there the whole time. Now, that didn't end up happening, but it unlocked something in my brain about, like, well, I can't really trust a lot of what he says. And that starts to be borne out. And this sort of pin drop moment is delivered amazingly. It's such a great way to begin the Usual Suspects ending.
In the critical moment, Jean-Francois, our historian, is at this vampire ball in honour of murdering and executing Gabriel and Celine, and he bumps into Keschel Voss, one of the characters that we have seen throughout Gabriel and Celine's stories, who is at so many pivotal events. And he mentions, offhandedly, I can't remember the exact thing, but he's basically like, oh yeah, it was really brutal though what happened to patients. And Keschel Voss goes, what? He's like, you know, the whole bringing her back of the vampire and her dying here and there. And Keschel Voss is just like, Fabian killed patients like years ago. He ripped her head off. And Jean-Francois is like, but she came back as a vampire. And then Keschel was like, no, he ripped her head off. We've established that's not how it works. And this is the first domino. in Jean-Francois's head.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it's this great moment where he goes, yeah, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, that does feel like a bit of a retcon in his story. Hang on a minute.
And then you go, wait, if he was lying to me about that, what else was he lying to me about? It's a great spiraling moment from Jean-Francois. And he's freaking out because he's walking back and forth. Because he's like, if I tell Margot that I really screwed up, what's she going to do? And you can feel the stress and tension he's feeling. And it amplifies the approaching climax. And there's a whole bunch of stuff, which, you know, you yourself might have noticed throughout the book, like how at the end of the second book, Gabriel and Celine have a fist fight and Gabriel rips her, like, her silver Hannibal Lecter mask off her face and you go, oh, interesting, why would you do that, Gabriel? And then everything starts to fall together because he storms into the party and sees Gabriel and Celine wrestling on the ground, and you're like, those two are genuinely, like, they're freeing each other. And throughout the book, I was paying a lot of attention to what Joaquin was doing with the keys he kept being handled. I'm like, okay, he's spiriting keys away. This is going to pay off. And it does. And the real motif, which I have gone back, I've reread a good portion of Empire the Vampire before this episode, and this is set up from, like, chapter 2 of the book. The moth bouncing around in Gabriel and then Celine's cells has been there since the first book. And it's Dior, who's we never got told she could use the classic Asani turn into a moth move, but she can, and she's here. She didn't die. She flutters down. She turns into a wolf. She doesn't do that often, it turns out, but she does it now, and it's a red slaughter of vampires.
I adored this climax. I particularly like how Jean-Francois, he's running through it. He's like, what do I do? Everything's going to hell. And it's like, what does anyone who wants to live forever do? They run. And he's running through the castle. And as he runs through, he keeps having to stop in his tracks and look on as one of the characters we thought was dead comes, like, crashing through. And it's like just ripping vampires up left, right and centre. It's like, oh my god, Aaron and Baptiste.
Phoebe's back, Lachlan's back, Aaron's back.
It's great to have this moment. This is the final bit. And this is the bit of, like, kind of the genius, the bit where I've had to go like, oh, Christoph, you had it in you. This is so clever, so brilliant to have all these moments of like, that doesn't make sense. Why are we doing this? That's confused me. That seems like a retcon. And then to be like, it was all part of my master plan. You're like, oh, you sweet son of a bitch. I love you.
A lot of them work. Some of them don't. I feel like we have highlighted the main one. I kept trying to justify to myself why the incest thing happened. It's just still to me a bit of an unforced error, but there's no explanation for that in the thing unless he was seriously like, no, we have to genuinely, this is going to make the story work if we had this whole incest thing. Maybe it'll distract Jean-Francois. But a lot of stuff in this book, it turns out, when they corner Jean-Francois down in Celine's cell, and he's like, what this stuff? Like, what about your, why isn't your aegis glowing? When didn't, your faith should have come back. He's like, oh no, I fucking lied about that. I completely made that up. And there is one thing about this that kind of works on one hand and kind of doesn't. Because Jean-Francois looks at Gabriel and realizes that he doesn't know this man. And on one hand, that's a striking moment of tension, relief, and terror. But also it's kind of true for the reader. We spent 3 really long books getting to know Gabriel. And a lot of parts of his story turns out aren't true. He tells us that most of the story was true. It's just little details he had to change. And I kind of believe that is probably the case. But the huge thing that he was lying about is Gabriel's addiction is pretty much cured. He's not actually falling to uncontrollable bloodlust. That was a lie. And it's a huge source of attention in the final book. So to say actually that was just a fib, on one hand, that's kind of cool. On the other hand, it's kind of like, oh, well, a lot of the stuff that made this book compelling is just gone.
And you now arrive at the key point. Things like patience never being brought back. Things like Gabriel's character not really being the one presented. It's like, I love this ending. I love the fact that it's all part of the master plan all along. Like, that is awesome, but when you tell me that...
And well set up.
All set up, exactly. Like, that's so good. Also, there was another one about how they were trying to buy time, and I'm like, Christoph, no. No, you don't get that one. Slap your back down on that. How dare you? But the thing is, I liked feeling duped sometimes and stumbling into a plot twist. It can feel really fun, particularly when you then look back and see the setup and go, oh, the clues were there all along. This, though, and yeah. This is why it's so weird. I was speaking to my partner over dinner today. I was like, it's like, I know it's all fake. It's a fictional book. But
yes.
When you're like, oh, I wasn't getting to know the character as they are, or that character only exists within the story, that sort of meta-narrative, I'm like, well, I just don't know how I feel. I'm left a bit confused.
My main issue at the end of the book is I think it's a little bit too saccharine sweet.
All the characters come back.
The ending is a bit too happy. Not even just that characters come back, because I'm kind of fine with that. Aaron and Baptiste's story is so fundamentally doomed. Like, Aaron's a vampire. He's going to be possessed by an appetite for blood for the rest of potentially existence. And if he dies, he's probably going to go to hell. If any character could have died heroically, probably should have been Aaron. The fact that he's going to persist, and everyone's just kind of fine with this, including Lachlan, who, even if Gabriel was really exaggerating the friction in their relationship, he's still a silver saint. Surely he should have an issue of just permitting a vampire to live. Again, part of this is like, I had a strong idea for how I thought this was going to end. And part of that ending was Gabriel and Celine having one final farewell where they forgive one another as the sun finally rises, because they have, the whole point of this vampiric massacre was to fulfill a different prophecy. Five come onto one. Five bloods united. Which I have to say, my girlfriend got scarily close to a prediction on this. I was like 90% done with the book. She was on chapter one. She was in the prologue. She put down the book and says, I think this is how the book is going to end. And I was like, I'm 90% of the way through, and that's definitely not true. And she was way closer to being right than I was. But the point is, they've managed to bring back the sun. It's not back yet, but Day's death is clearing. A new world is coming, the Empire of the Dawn. And I was sure that as the sun rose, finally, Celine and Gabriel would have one final goodbye, and then Celine would allow the sun to consume her, because there's no such thing as an ethical vampire. I think if there's one thing we've learned throughout the book is that being a vampire doesn't make you evil. Choosing to persist as a vampire makes you evil. So the fact that Celine and Aaron just live on, it, to me, that was a bit too happy. And also, the ending's just a little fast, considering how long this book is. Everything gets resolved in one epilogue. And if that had been like three chapters, I think I would like the ending a lot more. And I'd be a lot more secure in how much I like it.
Often the way with big book series is the fact that the time difference between the climax and the final page can always feel incredibly brief. And this was no different. But I do want to kind of bring this statement to a close. While there was a lot wrong in this book, and potentially I think more wrong in this book than I had with Empire of the Damned,
agreed,
which I do think now is probably my favourite of the trilogy.
Agreed.
I still feel that I can recommend people try this out. It does not retroactively ruin the trilogy.
Agreed.
It has its issues, but what it does right, what it continues to do right, is that even when it's been stupid or not its best or a bit weird or gross, it consistently shows itself to be cool and earnest with its characters in ways that I enjoy and I feel compelled to keep following them.
Agreed. I like the book overall. It has its faults. It's probably the worst of a trilogy. I keep seeing people say, everything about the death of Marin and the death of Rey now makes no sense. I literally do not know what those people are talking about. I don't understand why it's a big problem. And it's going to make it hard to recommend this book. Because one, you got to get through the barrier of being okay with the kind of cringy stuff. But you also have now the filter of people who are cool with the cringy stuff who have to also like the ending, and you can't tell them that it's a Usual Suspect style ending because it's too big of a twist. So you can't tell them and warn them in advance. So we've already told all of you, but yes, I recommend this book. I recommend this series, and I think we should find new stuff to enjoy about J. Kristoff. And the only thing I can hope for is that in the future, when the paperback comes out, they get the old artist back and give her her credit, because the new stuff was not as good.
Geordie, this has been great. This was technically my pick. So,
oh yeah,
where are we going next?
Yeah, so where we're going next is December. We're going to do our season, our seasonal season. And the question I have for you, Duncan, is, what are we doing? Like, we have done our best to find a Christmassy book every year up till now, and we have already scraped the bottom of the barrel. So I think, Duncan, this is legitimately probably going to be the last time we do a Christmas special, because after this, I think we're genuinely out. But I've got a Christmassy one.
Brilliant. What is it?
To be too obnoxious and on the nose, I had to do it. I mean, think about doing it for 2 years. Krampus, the Yule Lord by Brom.
That sounds amazing. I know of the movie, which I know is not necessarily an adaptation.
It's not the same, but Krampus is like a almost too on the nose idea for what to do for the Christmas special. But this is it. This is the last one, I think. We'll see you again next year if we've changed our mind. But I think this is it. It's about Krampus. What more do you want? It's Evil Father Christmas.
Looking forward to it. I'll see you next time. I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
And I've been your host, Geordie Bailey. Ho, 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 bitches.
Bye.